Hey, everyone. We are back talking about season 5, episode 11, Moroccan Christmas, which originally aired on December 11th, 2008. It's a very accurate Christmas if you live in Morocco, according to Phyllis.
This is the first Christmas party I'm throwing as head of the party planning committee. The theme is Night in Morocco. This isn't your grandmother's Christmas party. Unless, of course, she's from Morocco, in which case it's very accurate.
What do you think, Stephen?
Never been to Morocco, but the vibe seems right.
It does. She seems to have all the Pier 1 imports from Morocco ready to go in the office.
I was thinking and watching this. Do you have a favorite Christmas episode?
Oh, that's a question for a top four episode for sure.
Okay.
I can't think about that now.
I'll tell you what. I'll commit now to doing that with my wife. It'd be the two of y'all and me and Mary, because she watches every Christmas episode every Christmas.
Deal.
Okay, so we'll do that on top four.
That sounds great. All right, next Christmas, it's a date. Double date.
Okay.
Christmas episodes of The Office. I love it.
Got it.
But according to Michael, this is their best Christmas ever.
I think this is going to be the best Christmas party ever.
Pretty exciting, but everything gets like halted in the middle. It's not much of a party.
That takes a real turn.
It does. It takes a real turn. There's a lot of things that from some of the trivia and stuff online shows that they repeat things every Christmas. Like, I believe Michael's wearing the same tie basically for every Christmas episode. And we also have the Simpsons doll that's like hanging around the office wears a Santa hat mm-hmm. every Christmas episode. So those are all pretty
Perfect.
Consistent, which is pretty neat.
I was really surprised when I sat down to rewatch this that it's a short episode, because a lot of the Christmas episodes are in, you know, the hour format, but there's so much crammed into this. I don't know. I couldn't find anything if this was meant to be a longer episode and they had to cut it down. But like, I was shocked when it was over that it was only 22 minutes.
I was surprised, like, the amount of stuff that happened based on kind of the amount of montage time that they have in this episode. It felt like we got a lot more out of it than was actually there. Like, they spent a lot of time on Meredith writhing around, like, trying to avoid rehab, right? Like, there's like, that's a pretty long scene like, where Michael's chasing her through the parking lot. But yet it feels like it wasn't filler. It was just a very, very dense episode.
We've got a good cold open here. I love the desk pranks, like early on, you know, like the desk is in the bathroom and then mega desk. But Dwight comes in and his desk, it looks like it's just wrapped in Christmas paper, which is like a thing that happened to me once. So one year I went to like Macworld Expo and it was on like my birthday, and I came back and my coworkers had wrapped my desk in birthday paper, right? Like, it happens.
Yep. My brother and I wrapped a gift for my parents, which we couldn't disguise what it actually was. So we just wrapped it like the thing just for fun. So it was like a folding chair and we wrapped it, able to be folded and unfolded, all wrapped.
That's really good.
It took hours. Like, knowing how long it took to wrap one chair, that whole desk situation, that's a lot of wrapping.
Jim says he's a black belt in gift wrapping, and and Dwight replies, they don't give out black belts for things that are stupid.
I love Jim's look at the camera when Dwight says that. I wrote down that quote too, because it's just so perfect.
I am a black belt in gift wrapping.
Yeah, no such thing. They don't give out black belts for things that are stupid.
But apparently Jim is kind of a black belt in rapping, because when Dwight goes to sit down after kind of saying that this will take me no time at all, Jim, like, this is the stupidest prank you ever had. And it completely surprises him when everything on the desk, including his chair, is completely fake and just crumbles. I burst out laughing when that happens. It's such a fantastic visual gag.
I would love to know the behind the scenes of that, of if that was a one take deal, because what you said, right, that'd take a long time to set up. Like, did they get that in one shot? Do they have multiple desks built out of wrapping paper and cardboard? Like, I would love to know how this was done.
I wonder if they didn't tell Rainn Wilson, because he falls so naturally, but he would have gotten hurt if he actually did that. I don't know. Like, because it just seems so, he doesn't expect it at all. It just happens. And I love looking at the bottom of the desk chair, how it's totally constructed out of like just cardboard squares, and you can like kind of see some of the inner guts of like what was actually under there. Gosh, the props department probably had a really good time with that one.
Yeah, it is a top-notch desk prank.
I wonder how many people have recreated that in their own lives, like after they saw that and they're like, oh, we got to do this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure if you go on YouTube and just search like Stapler and Jell-O or anything from this show, people have recreated it in their workplaces.
Office pranks in real life.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be there.
Oh, yeah.
Well, for this episode, Phyllis is in charge of the Christmas party. And I really like that Phyllis goes to this kind of exotic, really cool themed Christmas. And we see this from her a lot. She is really a spicy, interesting person. And you don't think of that from her when you see her and you see the way she speaks and kind of she's quiet in the background. But then when she gets her camera time, she is off with Bob Vance from Vance Refrigeration, being all sassy. She's throwing Moroccan Christmas parties. She's like, this isn't your grandma's Christmas party. She is just so lively and exciting of a person underneath her Mother Goose facade.
Yeah, and the even to the reason that she's in charge. So she has thrown a coup in the party planning committee because she knows she remember at the end of the previous season at Toby's going away party, she catches Angela and Dwight in the office in a compromising situation, and so she's luring that over her, and there's this talking head that says, for it to be blackmail, I think it would have to have a formal letter. I mean, maybe, like, I don't know, but she is, you know, to your point, she's not just a soft-spoken person in the office. Like, she's playing the game, and she knows that she has this on Angela, and she just gets the most mileage out of it possible. And as we see at the end, she's not afraid to break the deal once Angela does.
Yeah, that was pretty strong of her. Although, like, so I think she's being very cruel to Angela throughout this entire episode.
She is.
But we have seen Angela being equally cruel to Phyllis before, and this is kind of a vengeance thing, but it's one of those, oh, if you're a good person, you're better than that. Blah, 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 blah. But no, Phyllis is getting her revenge. And I couldn't believe that Phyllis had I don't know. Can we say balls? Is balls like saying that someone has balls? Is that still okay? I'm going to say it. This is The Office.
Go for it.
Phyllis had the balls to kind of call Angela's bluff when Angela was like, you're not going to tell anybody. This will never happen. So I'm not listening to you anymore. And Phyllis does it. And I think that that is like a big thing. Again, like you don't expect that boldness from Phyllis. And it's all over this episode.
I mean, look, there are some things in the show between the characters that feels over the top or in a way that maybe wouldn't play out in real life. But like if you were in Phyllis's shoes, this would be a thing that like a normal people would be tempted to do, right? It's not completely out of left field that any person would act this way, especially to someone who, like you said, has been so mean to her over the years. And in big and little ways. And we see Phyllis kind of get back at Angela in little ways too, right? So she comes to her desk and she has the little nativity scene out and she like puts things in the drawer that aren't, I guess, Moroccan themes. Like you can keep the camels, but you know, you can't keep the other things. And she like swoops baby Jesus into the desk drawer, makes Angela very upset. And it's those little interactions that, you know, she is really getting back at what has probably been years of abuse. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. I mean, everything that Phyllis did, Angela had something of why it was terrible. You know, green is whorish. Orange is whorish. Everything you're doing is terrible. Like, everything you do is wrong. Like, why don't you think? This is so stupid. You know, so it has been years, and Phyllis is finally getting a chance to give Angela a taste of her own medicine.
Yep.
But I love that Michael also loves this party. He is so into it. He, even in the beginning, he's very excited that there's like these fancy invitations and that he has one. And he's like checking in with Phyllis if this gets us into the party, even though obviously it's an office party, everyone's there. I want to point out that there's alcohol at this party, which obviously Phyllis set up, but in previous Christmas episodes or previous party episodes, Toby has said that it's against policy to have alcohol served at the office party. So that's in a little bit of contention of like, how allowed is this? And also they have the corporate gift this Christmas is a shot glass, right? Which is so good.
It is good. I have some life advice for you.
Okay.
Don't ever drink a drink mixed by Michael Scott.
This is equal parts scotch, absinthe, rum, gin, vermouth, triple sec, and two packs of Splenda. Call it a one of everything.
So this drink that he describes, which is far worse than a Long Island iced tea for what is going into this thing. It's an excellent, excellent trivia question. Like, can you name the alcohols in Michael's drink, the one of everything?
I cannot, but I know it's basically just everything he had on the shelf.
And then two Splendas. Yeah. It ends in two Splendas. Mm,
that makes my body hurt thinking about it. And of course, Meredith is very into it.
Oh my God! Hit me again!
All right, one more time around the block.
The party gets pretty wild, probably because of all the alcohol, but it's mainly just Meredith getting wild. Everyone else seems pretty chill. Andy is off trying to learn how to play the sitar, which to everyone's annoyance, he's continuing to do. But I don't know, it shows Ed Helms' musical talent, and he's really good. Like, he is great at that kind of stuff, and he has a really good voice. So when he actually is singing and he's not just doing, but yeah, I like that he's kind of so distracted by this musical instrument that, like, he's just off in his own world doing that.
Hey, Ants, check it out.
There's a place in France where the naked ladies dance.
Really, Andy? It's Christmas, and you're singing about nudity in France.
There's a hole in the wall where the men can see it all.
But the line that really makes me laugh about this is he's playing, and Jim walks by, and he's like, Jim's like, oh, do you take request? And he's like, sure. And Jim says, could you stop? We're trying to have a Christmas party. It's so funny. Oh, poor Andy.
He wants to sound good, or especially at the end when he very sweetly plays a Christmas song for Angela and nobody claps because everyone just had this big reveal. We'll get to it. But it's like, even that, it was really, really great. Like, he it was very good. But then he was like, hey, you know, I just learned this thing. Give me a break.
I did notice that it's not Angela's favorite Christmas song.
Me too.
Which is Little Drummer Boy.
I was surprised at that. Either Andy doesn't know or he couldn't learn it. I don't know.
I think Andy doesn't know because Dwight knows, but Andy doesn't.
There was something I was just watching on YouTube because, okay, so here's a little inside glimpse into my life. We have a rowing machine, and so, like, we row, and I watch YouTube videos while rowing because it's entertaining. Yep.
Perfect.
And they're mostly about The Office. I was watching this one about, I don't know, hidden little secrets or something like that. They bring up that Dwight, in like one of the very, very first episodes, is humming Little Drummer Boy, like super early, before we at all have any inkling that him and Angela are together. He's singing it in some sort of like metal sounding, like, like, so, and he's just humming it at the desk, and Jim is looking at him, and they're having like kind of a, there's your stuff is on my desk rivalry or whatever they were doing. But it is there from the very beginning, and it's constantly brought up. And Angela even tells Andy that it's her favorite song when she requests it at their wedding. So he should know, but he doesn't.
He doesn't. I just, that jumped out at me when we were watching this.
Yeah, I feel like the writers would have put that in, as in like, oh, look how much Andy cares. He knows her favorite song because Dwight knows it. You know, and it's all over the place. It's mentioned multiple times throughout the series. So I think the fact that they didn't put it in and he didn't play that is pretty telling.
I guess we got to talk about Meredith now.
Yeah, we should probably talk about Meredith because she brings everything to a halt here, doesn't she?
She does. She's drunk. She's dancing. She lights her hair on fire accidentally.
She's burning.
That, I am so focused on Meredith's hair in this episode. It is, what is happening? Is that a wig? It looks very wiggy, right?
It's got to be. Yeah, it looks super weird after it's burned. It's got to be a wig.
It's like plasticky wig. It like melts. It like shrivels up like when you melt plastic.
Yeah, it's not not their best work. But so she catches her hair on fire. Kevin calls her Fire Girl.
Yes.
Which is a throwback, of course, to the excellent episode, The Fire.
Fire Girl.
Too soon. Too soon. And then Michael decides to hold an intervention. And there's this little snapshot of him and Toby and Oscar standing at Pam's desk trying to decide when to do it. And they are going to do it now. We're going to do it after the break. And they decide just to do it then. And Oscar's like, do you know what you're doing? And it's like, Oscar, of all people, should know that Michael doesn't know what he's doing, but they don't stop him. It gets stopped eventually, but everyone sits down and Michael tries to hold an intervention.
So how do you feel about this? Because I was looking at this in a way that I was like, it's a little bit of a different thing for Michael. I know he normally does things for attention for himself, but I feel like he's kind of caring about Meredith a little bit more than everybody else. I know he's kind of doing it for the spectacle of it a little bit, but he could have been way more Michael for that to be the case. I don't know. There's just something about it that it's like when you see someone going through something that's obviously a problem, most people try to ignore it, which is what the majority of the office is doing. They're like, oh, it's Meredith. Yeah, she lit her hair on fire, but we can't deal with this now. It's in the middle of our Christmas party, right? But Michael is kind of like, no, we have to address this. And he's actually seeming like he's trying to help Meredith. Like he's more focused on actually helping her than having fun at the party. Because, I mean, especially that time where, like, after the intervention itself, they go into his office and they're like in there for what some of the characters say, like 45 minutes or something like that, just talking. And he's trying to like convince her to go with him so that he can get her to rehab. I don't know. That seems like a big thing for Michael to like remove himself from the party action of like being the bartender and like exciting people with his drinks and, you know, having the focus on him. And he's actually trying to help her. So like, how do you see this?
We talked a lot about how Michael has redeeming qualities, and I feel like his caring for people is one that they go to a lot, and that he is doing this because he is genuinely concerned, because he does see his coworkers as family, right? And in that worldview, someone in his family has a problem, and that he feels like he is equipped to deal with. And so it didn't seem that out of character for him, he did it in the most Michael way possible, like with everyone you work with coming and doing this bigger invention, right? Like maybe that's not the way to do this sort of thing. I've never been in this situation, but I would imagine maybe a smaller conversation may be warranted. But I think it's just him kind of going back to that sweet side of his personality. He's genuinely concerned about her and wants to help.
The intervention itself, as they're all sitting around on the floor without their shoes on, totally becomes one of those conference room scenes where it just gets away mm-hmm. from Michael so quickly, and everyone starts interjecting their two cents and egging on Dwight and putting in their little chime-ins of and just derailing the conversation completely. I love that the idea of bringing this cast together and bringing all these people together, that just happens whether they are in the conference room or they're having an intervention about Meredith. Like they just go off the rails and just start making jokes about each other. And I love that. I love that they brought that into the Christmas party.
The next time you light yourself on fire, we are not going to help put you out.
Oh, as fire marshal, I would have to.
Dwight.
She is a hazard to the other people of the office.
Oh, okay.
I suppose I could do it if it was a controlled burn in a well-ventilated area.
Yeah, but you're going to need a permit for that.
Oh, right. That'll take a couple of weeks.
I can get you one in an hour.
Really?
Okay, you know, this is over.
Yeah, Dwight does have some real gems here. So he talks about if she comes in dead, he'll stab her in the brain with a wooden stick. That's how you deal with that. Dwight also reveals the Schrute family five-finger intervention, which is, I paused and wrote it down, awareness,
education, control,
acceptance,
and punching.
It's such a good trivia question. Punching.
Punching. They're all pretty good. 1 through 4, it's a pretty good list. Number 5 gets a little spicy.
There's always a little bit of spice when it comes to the Schrute family traditions. I mean, come on.
It's It's true. They get married and then standing in a grave. I mean, what more do you want?
And they shoot their dead.
Yeah. You got to really make sure. Well, if you don't, then you got to get ready to stab them in the brain with a wooden stick. I mean, come on.
You have to be prepared.
Yeah, that's just common sense, Tiff. Come on.
It's true. It's true.
There's also an Andy talking head in here where he talks about his relationship with alcohol in college.
Can you name all of his nicknames?
I know there was Ace is in there because he aced all of his classes. There was another one before that. I don't remember the one before that.
Puke. Ace. Buzz.
They called me Ace. Got straight B's. They called me Buzz.
I know from, you know, other episodes, maybe later or before, but we also have Boner Champ and Nard Dog. So I'm trying to think, like, that's another one. I'm mentally prepping here for trivia, obviously, because, like, that's a lot of nicknames for Andy. He has a whole bunch, and three of them come out here.
Yeah. You know, he go in, he polish someone's empties, he do some body shots off myself. It's like, oh, Andy, that's...
It's what are you doing? Like the crook of your elbow? Like, where would you do it from?
Yeah, I don't know.
Just cup your hands.
You got to be real flexible.
Yeah. Ooh. Ah. Ooh.
It's just not good. Not good at all.
Or is it very good? Nobody. I don't know. I'm sorry. I was just playing devil's advocate. Sorry.
I didn't party in college. I don't know.
I did a little bit. I was in a sorority. I ran with a beer bottle and chipped my tooth. So, you know.
Oh, wow. That's...
Yeah, it was dumb. Got it filed down.
They called me Chip. Was your nickname Chip after that?
That's good.
they called me Tooth.
I like Chip better. Chip's better. Yeah.
Yeah. Tooth is not a good nickname.
Tooth is a terrible nickname.
My nickname was Puke.
So during the intervention, Meredith does admit to being addicted to something, which is porn to everyone's horror. But
yeah,
I want to bring up that back in, I think, Women in the Workplace, Meredith does have a moment where she seems like she was in AA because she introduces herself. She's like, hi, I'm Meredith Palmer, and I'm good at public relations, or whatever she says. And it's like she might have been in rehab before, but now she's like in this giant denial that she's an alcoholic. But again, she is also extremely drunk that she just lit her hair on fire. So, yeah, there is definitely some history with Meredith and alcoholism.
I mean, I think like there's even scenes like where they're in her van, there's like empty bottles. I mean, it's clearly a thing that she has struggled with.
She drinks out of her desk too. She has like stuff in her desk drawer. She's like, right. It's all throughout the entire series.
I'm not an alcoholic.
You can say it as loudly as you want, but we're not going to believe you.
We should probably talk about Dwight's scheme for this Christmas in order to make some money off of the children of Scranton and their lazy parents.
It's so good. So there, Dwight says that he does all this research and he picks the popular toy of the season. And like, you know, we've got young kids, you know, that sometimes like a character or, you know, something is popular for a time. This year it is Princess Unicorn.
Half girl, half unicorn. Catchphrase, my horn can pierce the sky.
It's so ridiculous, but plausible, which is what is the best part of this. Because, I mean, those toys are usually so insanely random, right? It really, really is. But Dwight comes in with an armful of these pink boxes of this ridiculous doll.
Hey, is that Princess Unicorn? I thought they were all sold out.
They are now.
Cool. My horn can pierce the sky.
Which is a song that Michael definitely knows. He definitely knows who Princess Unicorn is. He knows that it's sold out. I mean, he is like in touch with what is going on.
I think he just watches a lot of TV. That's why he's able to sing the jingle so easily. My horn can pierce the sky.
We also have a little song from Dwight, which is something that Mary and I repeat to each other during the holidays.
Fa la 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 ka-ching.
Because, we see parents coming in throughout the episode and giving Dwight like $200 and walking away with the doll.
Yeah.
So it's pretty funny that he has obviously advertised this somewhere, that they're coming up to this office like during the Christmas party, these strangers, and purchasing dolls. We do see Toby at one point. He is just such this actor, how he plays Toby is just, he's so droopy dog. Like, it's so sad and painful, and every part of this hurts because he calls up asking his daughter if she's ever heard of Princess Unicorn. She gets all excited on the phone. You can kind of hear it. And Toby gets all like puffed up that he's going to be the hero dad by getting this crazy toy. And when he finally decides to go over and approach Dwight to buy it, Daryl is there purchasing the very last one.
I need the doll. I need the doll. I'm begging you. I need it more than anything in the world. I need this doll. Daryl, man, I need this doll.
Poor Toby. He's going to be a hero. He's going to make his ex-wife so mad. And Daryl beats him to the punch.
Toby's always losing. He's mm-hmm. always losing. And it sucks so much. And it just, I think you feel his face like drop a full inch and it's just going to stay there now. Like he's just aging in front of you as this mm-hmm. is happening. And it's really quite well done where we never see the doll. We only see Daryl like holding the box. And Toby is absolutely desperate to get this doll. As Dwight says, it's out of his hands now. He already sold it to Daryl. And Toby just absolutely breaks down like, I need to buy this doll. So Daryl kind of exploits him and kind of very much exploits him and says it's going to be double the price now. It's going to be $400. Toby doesn't have the money. There's this whole thing. Finally, Daryl says, fine, you can owe me. He hands him over the doll and he turns it over. And the doll, unlike a lot of the others that we've seen, this doll is black. And Toby just looks at it. This is such a painful moment.
And he's you can see like the wheels turning in his head of like, what do I say? What do I say? And he sort of squeaks out, it's even better than the one I wanted.
But he stutters it out first. Like, he can't get it out.
it's rough. It's an awkward scene.
It's even better than the one I wanted.
You know, he paid $400. So like Dwight's marking it up. This is probably like a $30 doll, right? So he's selling it to Daryl for $200. He turns it over to Toby for $400. The whole thing is so painful and just taking advantage of Toby's situation. And poor guy. Poor Toby.
Poor Toby. But oh, man, that scene, the way it's done and the way it's written and how it's done so simply, it does this thing that The Office often is able to do where they present you with a visual moment and people in an awkward situation. And it's just, it's the cringe, right? Like it's the, you know, people aren't supposed to react in the way that they end up reacting and you don't want them to, but it happens anyway. And everyone's put into the situation and you have this whole world like watching you. I mean, how many people watch this episode? 8.79 million people viewed this episode when it aired, right? And it's just like, wow. These things that they pull out, these societal things that you encounter in a workplace with your coworkers and with people and how you choose to move through and navigate these situations. It's just, that's what makes this comedy so strangely cathartically realistic, but at the same time, it really makes you think in a positive way that you're like, I would want to better myself from that situation. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, no, because the whole show is designed to feel like it's just happening, right? These people are just doing things and there just happens to be a film crew there. And through that mechanism, it's like we're standing mm-hmm. there, right? The camera is us. And because it doesn't feel as scripted as it is, it doesn't feel as planned out as it actually is. It just feels like, yeah, this could happen in my workplace. This could happen to me. This could happen to my friend. You know, like we can all be in this world. And especially by this point in the series, you know, halfway through, we've known these characters for a long time. And so you can understand why Toby is so cringy in these situations. You can understand why Daryl, like, yes, of course, Daryl's going to try to flip this and like make a profit because Daryl kind of has that edge to him, mm-hmm. right? You, it all just flows very naturally from who we know these people to be.
Yeah. So who we know Meredith to be, now that the Princess Unicorn saga has kind of concluded and Dwight has made his healthy profit, which probably was a lot. I mean, he came in with, I don't know, maybe 12 dolls, right? And he sold out of all of them.
Yeah, he's made some serious money.
La 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 la, ka-ching.
Michael ends up kind of tricking Meredith into going over to rehab by telling her that she's going to be going out, they're going to be going out to some bars together. And I like that all the bars that Meredith kind of lists off when she's trying to guess where Michael is bringing her are all actually Scranton bars.
We just missed poor Richards.
We did?
Yeah, I thought we were going out for a drink.
Shoot. Oh, well, we'll have to go someplace else then, I guess.
Bob?
Yeah.
Cooper's?
You could go
Kelly,
there, sure.
Brix's, Carmen's?
Yes.
Fort and Gavin's.
I have a new place.
It must have just opened up.
Recently.
And we see a couple of them throughout the series, right? Like, Poor Richards is sort of a staple in this world.
Mm-hmm.
They're in his office for like 45 minutes before they go, and it's like, what happened in there? What is that conversation like? But yeah, so they drive to Sunrise Rehab, which is a great name. And the you mentioned it at the top, this scene where she is trying to escape and they're like running around the parking lot and like Michael runs in the trash can. The physical humor is so good because you see someone who is drunk and then you see Michael who is, you know, in his 40s, maybe not in the best shape. You know, they're like trying to like run around and it's just like a very funny scene to me. And then somehow he catches her and then he drags her in by the wrist, like scraping her across the floor. She's screaming like to the check-in desk.
No!
Start beating.
No!
Hello.
Oh, this man is crazy.
Can I help you?
This man is crazy.
I have a deposit. Alcoholic.
No.
So do I sign?
No!
And I like how Michael has that little confessional at the end about how now how he actually plans to get Meredith into rehab, because he says that she needs to hit her rock bottom, and he plans to be the one to help her do that. Like Jan.
Yeah. He says, yeah, I know I could do it. I did it with Jan.
Phyllis calls Angela's bluff, which we talked about earlier. And she ends up telling the entire office about the affair that's going on between Dwight and Angela.
Angela's having sex with Dwight.
And Andy isn't in the room to hear it. And this makes for such an awkward ending. I love that they put this at the end of the episode and left it as this weird tension cliffhanger, because we're at a party. This whole thing explodes, like all this information explodes and comes out. Pam insisted that she knew as a gift. You know, Jim gives her the satisfaction that, oh, yeah, you knew.
I knew it.
You did not know it.
I knew some of it.
Everyone knew some of it.
It's Christmas.
You knew it.
Thank you. I knew it.
She knew it.
Yet we are left with everybody knows except for Andy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's playing the sitar on the floor, that Christmas song to Angela, and everyone already knows. Everyone is stone silent, and he plays, and he's like, you're supposed to applaud, you know, tough room.
Mm-hmm.
And then Angela just, like, whispers, I'd like you to take me home. And they leave, and everyone is just standing there. The shock value really pays off here, because we as the audience, we've known, right? We've known for a long mm-hmm. time that this is going on, but now everyone else except for Pam, who says she knew, this is news to them, even if they, you know, thought they knew a little bit of it, just to have it out there and no one can speak up, no one can pull him aside. They just let him, he just walks out, and this is left hanging until some point in the future.
Doesn't Ryan know? But Ryan was nowhere to be found in this episode. Oh, wait, he went off to Thailand, right?
I think he's in Thailand.
Yeah, that's where we left it. He was going to Thailand with some high school friends or friends from a high school.
And the cash that Kelly had after having one more adult playtime together.
Adult playtime. Come on, Steven.
I don't know. I'm used to
adult playtime.
Yeah. Adult playtime. Dwight, get out of my nook.
Hot. Anyway, but yeah, this is just left there. How do you feel about Dwight's reaction to all of this?
Well, don't look so surprised.
Dwight is fully aware of what he's doing, right? And he sees himself, and as we see the confrontation between Dwight and Andy unfold in future episodes, we see that Dwight views himself as a man and he views Andy as something less than a man. And that's where this comes from, I think. It's that he is proud that he has this relationship with Angela and proud that he has pulled it off. And there's no remorse in Dwight, at least right now, of this going on, even though she's engaged, even though Andy works 3 feet away from him, even though the wedding is going to be on his property. He just sort of bathes in it.
I don't know if he's bathing in it. So this is, it's going to connect, I think, more the next episode based on what ends up unfolding. But for those in the know, I'll just kind of keep it vague. I feel like Dwight is bragging more as a cover up for himself. I feel like he is putting on this persona of, oh yeah, I'm so manly, because he actually is kind of embarrassed about it, but he's hiding it under this machoism. Because I feel like Dwight, we come to learn and we see times where he is sensitive to people. He's a caring person. But in this situation, I feel like he feels so justified in his relationship with Angela because of what they've had and how long their relationship has been. And he sees Andy as like this Andy's the extra, right? Like that's what he's seeing this. Andy is the one interfering with what him and Angela have. And it's like he's just trying to essentially justify it with himself that he's so manly about it. And I think that we see a glimpse of that being a little bit true in the next episode when things kind of come out. I mean, the next episode's called The Duel, right? So we can all assume what's going to be happening. But that's where I want to think about Dwight, because I don't see him being that cruel and cold. In general, like, you know, I don't think that we would like him as much going forward if that were really true.
Yeah, I can see that. I guess we'll have to debate that next time.
Yeah, I really like psychoanalyzing these characters and thinking about their motivations, and because I don't know, I'm on the plane of everyone does things for good intentions for themselves until it's bad. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that anyone is like super malicious of a person in general. So I like to see like, why did they make these choices? And looking at characters like Dwight and looking at characters like Michael, who seem to make bad choices or like hurt people or do things in a bad way, it's like, well, if you think about like maybe why they did this, it kind of can be explained. And I think that that's the humanizing part of the show, because all of that stuff, it's not just speculation. A lot of it's kind of written in there as we see these characters develop.
That's a good point.
So we will be back next time talking about The Duel. And that's when we get to hear about what's going to happen with Dwight and Andy and Angela and this horrible tension that is stewing in the office. And I want to mention another thing. They have to work together. You know, this isn't just like a group of friends that can choose to see each other or not. They're all coming in Monday, whether they like it or not, or like after vacation, whether they like it or not. Like, they're all going to have to be there or like quit their job. I feel like these workplace situations are way more stressful than friends hanging out, because you have to show up again and face everybody. And that's hard.
Yeah. And when everyone knows your business in your friend circle, work can be an escape, right? And if everyone at work knows your business, then you're stuck there 8 hours a day.
Yep.
And that's unfortunate.
And you have to try and ignore it and actually do your work or not. And it's, oh gosh, the tension. I just feel it in my spine. Anyway, thanks for listening. Be sure to go over and follow us at tall_beats on Twitter and subscribe to become a member at The Incomparable for fun goodies and to chat with us in the members only conference room over on Slack. And we will be back talking about The Duel. Are you ready? Are you ready, Stephen?
I am. I'm getting the Prius warmed up now.
You don't have to warm up a Prius. It just goes.
My horn can pierce the sky. Mm-hmm.